正直やっさ。
Hello, listeners. This is your belly drumming host, Martin Kessler. And today I'm joined by Amanda.
Hello, Martin. Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.
And you're somebody I know mostly through film Twitter. Mm-hmm. And your Twitter handle is WMass Liberty.
Right? Yes, it is.
Okay, so film Twitter people can check that out.
Absolutely.
And, and today we're here to talk about Pompoko.
Yes.
Which, it's a Studio Ghibli film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of excited to talk about this because usually Studio Ghibli, it's a little bit synonymous with Hayao Miyazaki.
Yep.
Who was a producer on this, but it was directed by Isao Takahata, who's kind of the other big person in Studio Ghibli who passed away sort of recently.
Yeah, lung cancer. I think it was last year.
Yeah, yeah. I think like every time I saw behind the scenes stuff, he was smoking. So
yeah, there's actually a funny story. I guess at this point, it's sad, but Suzuki, who's I guess one of the three important figures at Studio Ghibli, kindly asked him if he would stop smoking. I think it was like 5 years ago, and supposedly he just like said bowed and he said thank you and walked away, and he did quit. But I think it was unfortunately too late.
Yeah. If you watch the Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, Hayao Miyazaki smokes.
Yes.
And he's smoking, and then they'll stop to do, like, exercises, like jumping jacks.
Yes, he'll put the cigarette down to do the exercises.
So, I don't know how it balances out, but I guess it does.
Maybe it cancels it out. I mean, it's funny because I always...
cancel each other.
Yeah, I always... It's funny that I loved watching that documentary with him, just seeing how much he smoked, because I just kind of... At least for me, whenever I've watched anything on any animator, they're almost always chain smokers. So it just kind of fit in with that immediately. Just seeing him is kind of how I imagined he was.
So, some animated films, like I'm pretty sure you can see like cigarette ash in like a Ralph Bakshi movie, like on the actual animation cell.
Yeah, on the actual cells. Yeah, they did a darker like... tone for like lizards.
And this film, this is kind of like the middle part of his career. Mm-hmm. It came out 1994, and it's all about a group of raccoons who can shapeshift, and it ties it to the real suburban expansion of Tokyo, I guess, starting in the 1960s, like that economic boom period. So it's kind of a mix of folklore-inspired mythology with more slice-of-life stuff, and that's kind of the two things I think a lot of people associate with Takahata.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a common theme, too, I think I kind of noticed with his movies. He usually deals with selfishness. And that's kind of, I mean, probably his, I mean, I think maybe his most famous, Grave of the Fireflies, really deals with, it's kind of that story of selfishness, unfortunately, that young boy trying to care for his sister. And that, I think, is kind of a little bit, like, prevalent in this movie, too, in Pompoko, which is essentially why their homes, their forests, their mountain are being taken away from them.
Yes. There's that sort of plea directly to the audience to please be considerate about the environment. Like, it's an environmentalist film in specific, which a few other Ghibli films are. Like, Princess Mononoke feels very grand and epic and mythologizes this sort of environmental themes and that kind of clash between the environment and human progress. And it's a little bit more... I don't want to say like even-handed, but like I feel like it gives a little bit more consideration to the human development.
Yeah, it does.
Or, you know, like you can sort of say there are environmental themes in something like My Neighbor Totoro, but it's very subdued and it's more for little kids. Like I think...
Yeah, it's very much in the background in Totoro, I feel like. I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You almost don't even pick up on it, but you sort of just develop those associations as you watch it. And that, I don't know if it's because of the age that Pompoko might be targeted for. Like, it sort of feels maybe in between.
It kind of does.
The audiences, yeah.
Yeah, and which is, you're saying that, it's kind of how I felt about the way that the raccoons, the animation styles are in the movie. Mm-hmm. It kind of, like, the realistic parts, I feel maybe is more for, you know, I guess, just my guess, an adult audience, whereas when they're, you know, standing on two legs and they have more human-like features, it's kind of almost for children, or maybe to see how they relate amongst each other.
And sometimes it goes really cartoony.
Yes.
A raccoon will smack another one on the head, and it turns into, like, a... you know, like Saturday morning paper style
Yeah,
cartoon.
it almost looks like his My Neighbors the Yamadas type of simple
Yeah,
animation
yeah.
style. Yeah, which was after that. But yeah, I do love that. Just all the different styles in the film. I think there's like maybe four. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's four different styles going on.
Which he makes work, I think, partly because it's about transformation and or the raccoons can transform, and that's something that comes from actual mythology. It's not just invented for the film. It builds on that mythological tradition of raccoons being shapeshifters and tricksters. And but it's sort of neat when you see it transforming from a realistic looking raccoon, and in some of the animated, more realistic parts, like it looks almost like documentary footage, and it has kind of this documentary tone to the whole film, which I like, and then it blends that with the more cartoony stuff.
Yeah, I love that because it's kind of I know he did, I'm trying to remember the name of it. He did a documentary, like a live action documentary that's almost like 3 hours long on canals. Yeah, and it's kind of maybe that had somewhat of an influence on it because he loves the look of his native home of Japan, and he also loves Europe. And he was trying to do something, I guess, a little more realistic. Just the way, like, I love when they transform from being on like two legs because they're socializing with each other to then when they have to go and look at what the construction workers are doing to their land, destroying their land, and they just kind of quickly morph into how we see them. And then you can see like the really detailed individual blades of grass and then the trees and the nature around them from a totally different perspective.
And a lot of the shots of the construction site and things like that look almost like they probably took a real photograph and then just used that as a very close reference in creating the animation. So like it has that realistic look to it. And I sort of feel like Takahata, especially like I was watching some of his other films this week, and it seems like in contrast to Miyazaki, he's way more comfortable with going off of a character model and you know, just sort of playing with the designs, and he has sort of a looser visual style. A lot of the time you see like the brush strokes in some of these designs. Like there's the one part where a raccoon turns into the white fox at a temple to try to chase away the people who are going to knock it over. And you know, it just looks like something a person did very quickly and with skill, obviously, but it has that sort of fluidity in the style and kind of a looseness. Like it's not a very rigid character model that they seem to use.
It's got some sort of deep complexity to it, as simple as it is. And maybe that's because of his just understanding of nature and the way things move. But it's something that I think is somewhat unique to Miyazaki and the way that he animates his films. Because I feel like a lot of his backgrounds are also like hyper realistic sometimes. But then there's like the just the simplistic traditional anime type of characters we're used to in the forefront. But Miyazaki kind of, I think, deals with like more fantasy. And I think Takahata is a little, maybe a little more grounded and like kind of like a totally different, like maybe more naturalist perspective on things. And that's with his style too.
Like Miyazaki, I think like he'll build a world, and you know, everything sort of sticks to the rules of that. And Takahata, it's like playing with conventions from our world and adding a sort of cartoony quality to it or exaggerated quality to it. I think that's right. Like just some of the images he comes up with that, you know, they're not meant to be taken literally. Like you have that leaf and all the little construction trucks and bulldozers and excavators are chewing away at it like beetles eating away at the leaf, you know, like
Oh
it's
yeah, that's so excellent. That's when they're describing that project. I think it's like the new Tama project when they were, and really starting to like expand the suburbs outside of Tokyo. I think they didn't they say in the beginning of that. I think it was they were trying to make room for 300,000 Japanese. So it kind of
I
gives you
guess
a real perspective of how large these apartments are. But yeah, I love that sequence with the tiny little bulldozers on that leaf, just kind of slowly eating it away, and that's kind of like gives you a look at what's to come in the movie so, for the raccoons.
He sort of means it as visual metaphor, and you sort of understand that it's kind of working on that level. And when it shifts back and forth between like the cartoony raccoons and the realistic raccoons, you can sort of think like, okay, you know, the cartoony raccoons are a metaphor for how the realistic raccoons would act, and you have that kind of understanding that this isn't necessarily meant to be literal in the way that like the fantasy of Princess Mononoke is sort of grounded in its own reality.
It really is, yeah. It's incredible that world that Miyazaki created for Princess Mononoke. But this one is kind of, you know, and I know we kind of already touched on this, but it's he's really just showing us our world that we live in. And I think I love that kind of that way that he differentiates from what we see and what is there that we don't normally see.
Exactly. And like a lot of the film is sort of commenting on modern life and urban life, I find, like, especially you have those scenes where the raccoons disguise themselves as people and go to the
city. I love that. Yeah. the energy drinks that they're responsible for making popular because it takes so much energy to transform into a human. I just love like little details like that, or like why they have the dark circles under their eyes because they're just exhausted from doing it. It's all the fatigue. That was like one of my favorite parts of that movie when they first touched on those like little details. And it's like, you know what, if I was little, I would, you know, and I was asking, you know, my parents about, you know, oh, these raccoons, like, how do they do this? That's probably something they would have said to me.
Right.
So it just fits in very well, even for like the younger audience.
Yeah. Like you can sort of see him instilling this sense of wonderment for younger audience members, where you can kind of like imagine what goes on when you're not looking, or you know, like that's really fun. Oh my god, the raccoon when he's playing pachinko machine, like all the places where you sort of see people with these like dark circles under their eyes, you know, I think that's funny.
It's like, it's kind of like reminding me a little bit of like They Live, and it was like, so now I'm just gonna like, I'm just, when I'm out now, I'm gonna see if I see anybody with dark circles under their eyes. And I don't need any sunglasses to do that, so it's a little easier, I guess.
It's really funny. I mean, it's not all just funny stuff. Like, there's a lot of sad things that kind of go along too with the raccoons interacting with urban life. Like,
he shows us a lot of dead raccoons.
Dead raccoons, I know.
Yes.
Like, even as an adult watching this, I'm like, oh man, this is really bumming me out. All these dead cartoon raccoons.
But he's showing us a reality that he's comfortable showing us. You know, the
exactly.
reality
yeah.
of really the reality of war. I think that's kind of a common theme he has. But yeah, it is. Like you said, even now, it's disturbing to watch it and see that like there's a pile of the dead raccoons that lose a battle at the end of the movie, and that always kind of disturbed me. And that one, I don't know, I always took it as it was shot and killed. Maybe you took it differently, but the one that imitates a woman at one point,
the one that's riding the bicycle, and then the security guy shoots the gun up at the air. I thought it was maybe that the raccoon was just startled and fell off the bike.
That's what I'm hoping.
Kind of dazed look. That's what I'm going to tell myself, maybe.
Yes, because it lands on its back and then it has its tongue hanging out like something like, you know, like Wile E. Coyote would do. And,
right.
And I was just like, oh, I hope he wasn't shot, please.
Right. And I mean, that's when the raccoons are playing all their pranks to try to chase people off, which even that, it's not all innocent. Like, people get killed by these raccoons.
Yes, they do. Pretty frequently too. I think initially, like, they decide there's like a three separate attacks on the construction workers. Mm-hmm. And it's all about like how they knock these large gigantic like tractor trailers off the road. And then like they're celebrating it because I believe it's like postponed construction for a day because of all these accidents. And they blame it on the weather, I think, like the erosion from the rain. And then, like, one of the elders is like, oh, we should pray because three humans died. This is terrible. And then they start to pray, and then they all just start laughing. And I was like, well, I guess that's how you had to handle that, yeah.
Oh, my God, when they all have their heads bowed, and you just see them, like, start cracking up and trying to hold back the laughter, then that just makes it worse.
Yeah, it's like, you know, in school when your teacher does something funny and you're all trying not to laugh. That's what I thought of.
Exactly.
Yeah, can't help it.
I thought it was sort of interesting, too, the horror angle to a lot of their transformations and a lot of their tricks that they play on these people, transforming into scary things, or, like, when they're turning into the people and making their faces disappear. Like, that, to me, felt like something you'd see in a Junji Ito horror story, you know?
Yeah, that was really frightening. Even as simply as it was animated, it was, you know, I don't know how I would have handled that. I probably would have handled it just like that cop, maybe worse, when they're doing that to frighten him.
No, that's freaky. And, you know, going to the construction site and opening the door and the kids with the demon masks are running. Like, there's a lot of kind of creepy stuff that they pull on the people.
Really creepy stuff. And it's kind of I read a little bit on the tanukis and their ability in Japanese folklore to transform into different things, and it's they like, aside from scaring people, making people look stupid. And I think this movie touched a lot more on the scare them part, but there, I guess there's a little bit of the let's make the humans look stupid. I mean, they did. I love the scene where there's the three of them basically as identical copies of these three construction workers, and they start chasing them. And scaring them, and they have their hands high up in the air, and they're jumping and running around and
Yeah.
screaming. Yeah.
Is that when they're going around that infinite loop? Like the
It is.
staircase going?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they just stop and turn around and go the other way. Yeah.
And of course, you have that great procession when they try to put on the big show when the Transformation Masters show up. And
Oh,
like a
yeah.
lot of it's just inspired by the Yoreitsu supernatural artwork. Like you see a lot of like 19th century wood blocks have skeletons and lanterns with
Right.
faces, and
Right.
again going back to these traditional images. And I think you even see some when the raccoons go to the library to study people, and they're flipping through the books, and like there's a silhouette looks like a fish or a whale, and then you flip the page and it's like a raccoon crushing a guy with its testicles.
Yeah, we got to get there at some point. That's a big part of
Right.
this movie. I love how in the English version they call it pouches.
Yeah, they had to dance around that somehow.
Yes, that's a way to dance around it. As silly as it is for myself and you and people that aren't, you know, I guess we aren't Japanese. I'm not Japanese. Maybe you are a little
No.
bit.
No,
But
not at all.
yeah. It's not treated in any sort of like sexualized silly manner. It's like a strength and sometimes they like that scene we're probably going to discuss. They're incredibly large and they use them as a weapon. So.
I mean, it's funny when they have that final battle with the humans and they're swinging it around like a weapon. It's pretty funny.
See, that scene is so hard for me because it's like I find that it's a little emotional for me because it's kind of
It's
like their
sad.
last stand and it's
Yeah.
sad. And then I guess, you know, just because, you know, I'm second generation American, but that's enough for me to be American. And then it's also really funny because they're using their testicles to fight. So I'm kind of conflicted when I watch it because I find myself crying and laughing.
That's what I like about the film, though. It sort of mixes that silly stuff with the melancholic. Like, that's
Yeah.
kind of what I find stands out about it.
It
And,
really does. It's got that dimension to it.
or, you know, even when it hits you hard, it knows how to pull back pretty quick and kind of bounce onto the next thing to keep you laughing. Like, another sad sequence that happens, I think, right around the same time as that last stand is when the old Transformation Master, who's kind of gone a bit senile with his, they called it like a Buddhist cult.
Yeah, and he's got them all singing and dancing.
Right.
And they're like,
You
oh,
know,
he
when he
finally lost his
decides that they're
mind.
just going to go off in a ship to Nirvana and they're all happy. And, you know,
Yeah.
it's sort of sad. Like, I don't know. It made me think of like Lord of the Rings when all the elves leave or something at the end. Like, they're just going to
Yes.
go off, like,
Yeah, that's
leave this
exactly what I
world,
thought of. Yeah. Yeah, I
Right.
was like, that's having me cry with Lord of the Rings, and I came pretty close with this. Even
Right.
though it's that master's like giant testicle, I think, that's their
Yeah,
boat.
they turn it into a boat. I mean, it's the same kind of humor. Like, you know, you watch cartoons. Sometimes it's funny when, like, I don't know, like Donald Duck gets kicked in the behind or something like that. Like, it has like sort of a similar, I
It
guess,
does. Yeah, it's got a little silliness there, like that you can only really do
silliness.
in
Yeah.
animation. And I think, and it's stuff that animators, at least in the United States in recent memory, don't do. So,
No.
and I think that's you know, I'm not saying they should all do it, but I think they, I wish they were a little more risky and creative. I mean, there's, because the sky's the limit with animation, and you can really do anything.
That's one thing you sort of feel in the film is just like there aren't any limits. And one thing I like about all the transformation is just how anything can be anything, and it sort of
Yeah.
feels very free in how it's animated and how just like sometimes how the designs change. Like, it's funny when the raccoons turn into humans, how you can kind of see a little bit of the raccoon design in their features, so you can tell who they are. Or there's that one
Yeah.
that like turns into the really handsome sailor looking guy, which I don't know why, that's
And then
really
there's like
funny
a
to
few
me.
that are always like really pudgy.
Yeah, and that like
Yeah.
a few can't quite get the transformations right. You know, there's just like a lot of creativity I find in how visually that's realized. And
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of that detail even and how simplistic like some of their individual like styles are for the different characters. It even when like they transform into or when they're learning how to transform early on, A lot of the different things they transform in are very similar to their features that they have, aside from even the humans they turn into.
There's that one part when they turn themselves into like bear traps.
Yes!
And you see them like opening their bellies and it's like full of teeth and it's kind of freaky for a little
It
minute,
is.
but
It's very
just
the thing, yeah. It gets interesting when they start to really learn from like the masters how to fully harness like all of their energy and that shared energy, and then how to use like the elements, and then they start just combining into these crazier, larger versions of different things.
I love the Masters so much, like just
Yes.
the how they're designed, you know, when they first show up as humans and they're really colorful and
I love
it's like
that
they're
scene so
showing off,
much.
you know.
I like when they get their taxi cab.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just the raccoon designs for them, I find are so much fun to look at, like
Oh, they're great.
the little wrinkly old one.
Yes. The wrinkly old one is very Yoda to me, especially when it's like, oh, I'm 999 years old. And I'm just like, oh, this is like when Yoda tells Luke he's, 900 years old.
Yes.
Yes, the same thing.
And it's sort of interesting too, the time span that it takes place over. Like, it has sort of this leisurely pace to it, and it's these little episodes as you kind of have, you know, one raccoon going on a journey and then the other one's playing pranks on people, and then there's like a little love interlude, and you kind of feel like it's very episodic, and it does have this overarching story about the destruction of their environment,
It
but like it
does.
feels sort of more like a series of episodes. And
It really does. And I don't know what you think, but I kind of felt that it really, I loved how he had it work with the seasons. So like you saw like, every spring, then they have that they go through that romance period like nature does, and then in the fall they're getting ready for winter, so that they harvest a lot and need a lot of food, or they try to scrounge around for a lot of food, and it kind of works very well with what they're dealing with losing their land. It all like just like for when the masters arrive, or when somebody is off on their journey to find the masters, it just kind of is like perfectly tied in with those seasons.
Yes. And development around Tokyo, like that doesn't happen overnight. So you sort of get the feeling that it's this kind of gradual problem that's just getting worse and worse that they have to try to find, they try to find solutions for and are ultimately not that successful in the end, tragically, you know. Like, it's sort of interesting too, the divisions between the raccoons. Like Gonta, we sort of mentioned, is the one that's more
It's more
militaristic and
aggressive, yeah.
more aggressive. He even tries to have a coup to kick over the
Yes.
raccoons, and then that promptly ends because they just start thinking about food, so they can't stay
Yeah,
focused on that.
tempura, I think. I love that. They're just like, oh, well, oh, I love tempura. What do you like? Oh, I like it with the mouse tempura, I think he
Mouse
says. Yes. Oh, that's
tempura.
delicious.
It's
Yeah. Forget the coup.
cute. He wants to fight the humans outright. Others think that maybe they should just reveal themselves to the humans and that would get them to stop. The fox who comes into the story more towards the end kind of suggests that, like, hey, you should just go and live amongst the humans and make money and live that way. And there's like different possible solutions, and none of them are really great for the raccoons who just kind of want to live the way they've been living in the sort of traditional way. I mean, I've worked in conservation and it can feel like, okay, we're just doing our best to delay the inevitable as much as possible. You know, it
It
can
feels
feel
hopeless.
really hopeless. Yeah, it's like a series of, okay, like how do we prolong this defeat as long as possible, you know, which can be very, very discouraging and disheartening. But
Oh,
like,
sure.
there's no victories. It's just, okay, this animal isn't extinct today and this isn't gone yet, you know. It can feel like that.
Yeah, you can feel alone in it too, and then the people have different perspectives on things, and I mean, I'm it's hard because I think just me personally, you can regulate too much and you can regulate too little. I mean, it's kind of and unfortunately there are people that are going to do things that they're just not going to think through the process. They're gonna think through a totally different perspective, or just have a different way of looking things that I'm not familiar with, and so you've just got all these clashing ideas and ways of thinking. And I think that Takahata and Miyazaki both do that really well, because at least for me, I don't feel they're necessarily preaching one extreme or another. They're kind of just like showing them as they are.
Yes.
And yeah, and they're kind of like, well, and he does a really good job with that with the different raccoons, like Gunta, and I think Shokachi is the younger one.
Yeah, like it would have been really easy to make them just unified, like all the raccoons are on the same side, so they're going to be fighting, you know, together and be sort of a unified force, but he adds that extra characterization and division and conflict of ideology just like within this raccoon community, which I find goes a long way in making it feel not overly simplistic.
Yeah, exactly. It feels really real, and it's how I wish current politics right now we were capable of handling things that way. That's kind of my opinion. What I feel we need to do, we need to be able to actually have a discussion, and celebrate different ideas, and eventually arrive at something that actually in the end we all it all works for us. I mean, I know that's impossible, but
discourse is dead.
It's totally dead. So it's kind of what the raccoons, I think, ultimately kind of arrive at somewhat, in my opinion, in this movie, because it's like, well, the humans, they make great food. We can't kill them all. What do we do?
And that final scene where they've sort of been living amongst the humans and then have that, like, that one final gathering in the park, it's kind of like, hey, it's too late for us, but maybe you could do something for somebody else. Like, it's so defeatist, and it's like so it kind of finds a way to not leave you on like a totally dark note by having a song and having everyone kind of get together once more at the end. But it has definitely like this sort of defeated note for these particular raccoons, in this segment of nature. And
it really does. Yeah,
even that, like, the way it's phrased, I watched it in both the English dub and the original Japanese, and
oh nice. They're both really different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there are a lot of differences. I was sort of interested because maybe the English version of that final speech didn't work.
Yes, it was really different. Yeah, I felt like it was an entirely different, like, coach giving a speech.
Yeah. It feels like really didactic in the English version.
It does.
Just the tone. I think it's partly like the voice acting and like a little bit of a difference in the translation anyway. The Japanese version of that final speech just like had a completely different feel to it or tone to it. And
it's beautiful. It's a little more about balance, I think, the Japanese version. I think they nail that.
And addressing the audience directly, like, it sort of works because, again, it has that somewhat documentary feel to it with the narration. Like, the narrator, it's not like a fairy tale book narrator. Like, the way they sort of narrate, like, ah, yes, raccoons do this and this, and actually they do this. It has this sort of matter-of-factness of maybe a documentary narrator, which I kind of liked.
Yeah, it does. A lot of the style of the background animation kind of, like, for example, like when they, at one point in the film, a bunch of raccoons that aren't able to transform knock a huge like excavator like over the side of the hill and completely destroy it. And then all these construction workers see it from the bottom of the hill, and people don't believe them that the raccoons pushed it over, but just seeing the remains of this excavator, it looks very real. It looks almost like a photograph of something that was destroyed. So there's even portions of that tie in with the realistic moments that the film has.
It just has that element to it where you can, I think, get away with a direct address to the audience, and it doesn't feel a Disney version of that would feel kind of disastrous. There are a lot of other children's animated films that have this kind of environmentalist message, and
Ferngully, like, comes to mind. That's probably
Ferngully,
the most popular one, which I don't really remember that much of other than it just preaching at me the whole time.
I remember it preaching at me the whole time, and also a very funny bat and a very scary Tim Curry. When he turns into like a Dark Souls monster.
Unnecessarily scary, yeah. It's like Black Cauldron levels of scary.
they could have made the humans like totally scary in this, and Ferngully, straight up demonizes industry. It portrays it like a monster, a skeletal fire-breathing monster. And this sort of feels like a step away from that,
which is kind of a reality with industrialized Japan.
There's still a comment on it, like, about it being poorly designed and messy and inconsiderate. Like, I think Takahata portrays it as inconsiderate and selfish more than evil, which I think
exactly, it's a selfishness theme. It's kind of really only thinking about, I think he's telling Japan, we can't just think about ourselves.
The scene towards the end when the raccoons just decide to transform the land to show people what it could be like,
that's a great scene.
What's kind of great about that, it's not a land without human beings. It's just sort of trying to show people living realistically, like in harmony with the
With
nature, and
nature, yeah.
it's saying, hey, this is kind of how it could be, and maybe if you put more thought into it, like there's still buildings and there's still places for
Yeah.
people to live. It's just not.
It's more you're just living in that balance with nature, as opposed to just that one extreme of just being the city. And then even at the end of the movie too, they mention that the narrator does, which I think is like Shokachi, the younger raccoon, mentions that, oh, now they recognize from our message that they give to the journalist, that we're important and nature's important, and they have different parks that they have protected for us. So they do make that point.
He has that sort of positive note of where their shrine used to be. That's the park, and that's like one of the most popular places in the town. And you see, like, there's a fountain there, and there's some nature there. Like, it's not completely
It's not
bad. It's
completely
just
lost,
not completely lost. I was sort of wondering too about, because there's so much traditional and mythological stuff worked into the film. Maybe the role of Shintoism in Japanese environmentalism, like if it's a little bit of a different tradition, or if thought process. Like I was reading a little while ago a book about Tanaka Shozu, who was sort of a conservationist pioneer, and I think the thing he was sort of most famous for is there's this copper mining operation that was polluting the surrounding area and got rid of the wood, so like there were landslides and killed a bunch of fish, and it was bad for the people living around because the soil's not secure and like all sorts of things like that. And that's 19th century. That still feels like when things were just becoming industrialized for a lot of the world. So like I was sort of thinking about maybe that relationship where traditionally in Shintoism there are spirits in nature, and at one point the raccoons transform into these like statues, Shinto statues, not the usual sort of Disney anthropomorphization of nature,
No,
but just to
no.
think that there's like life behind this and sort of a
It's like a spiritual
abstract
element in
spirit.
nature.
Yeah, that there's a spiritual element. Thank you for
Sure. No, 'cause
getting that out.
that's okay. Thank you. No, it's a kind of a common theme that Ghibli has, I feel like, in all their films. There's that layer there that at least myself, I mean, as much as I do love some Disney movies and some Pixar movies, like they
Sure.
doesn't have that layer there for me.
No.
Yeah, at all. And I think it's wrong for me to say that they're soulless, 'cause they're not, but there's this like spiritual understanding that's kind of woven into Ghibli's films, even ones that aren't as good, as, I mean, even like I'm trying to think in terms of Takahata. For me, probably my least favorite is My Neighbors the Yamadas, and that's still a totally fun movie and it's great.
It's still great, but it's a little bit more.
It reminds
I
me of the
always feel like my
Peanuts.
name, I would probably say it's my least favorite too, but I think just by virtue of it being kind of slight compared to some of the others, like they feel.
There's that layer,
I mean,
like
you
I said, there's
can't
that layer
like
there.
Princess Kaguya, like that movie hits me so hard, like it's
Oh,
not even funny.
it's such a beautiful movie. And it makes me think of God, I'm trying to remember the name of Kanichikawa's movie that he did. Is it The Princess and the Moon?
Yeah, that I mean that's also Princess Kaguya.
It
Like it's translated
is.
differently, but it's from the same story.
Yeah, I think it came out like in 1987. I know it's late 80s,
Yeah,
but
it's got that like foggy lens look throughout the whole thing, and
Especially like when the parents first discover her. I love how that's done. That Tale of the Bamboo Cutter, that's an old story too. I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like that might be the most common and one of the oldest fairy tales that most Japanese are familiar with.
I heard somebody call it one of the first science fiction stories because she
Okay.
comes from the moon, and I thought that was kind of an interesting perspective on it, but
Yeah.
I
It's
think it's
such an interesting movie that he did.
yeah.
I just love the style because it kind of feels like he's evolved even further from My Neighbors the Yamadas, and I don't know if that's because of how long he takes to make his movies, or
But it has that totally free style. Like a lot of it, when he chooses not to fill in the backgrounds, or when it just feels so free and loose in the animation style, like I find that really, really incredible. And there's a very similar part in Princess Kaguya. Like towards the end, they make a big show of it when the Buddha descends from the moon and takes her away. But like, there's sort of a similar moment when one of the old masters dies in Pompoko, and Buddha just descends and picks up. Like,
such a great scene on the cloud.
It's a striking moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not really commented on. It's just this sort of miraculous thing, seeing, you know, Buddha taking away a raccoon.
Mm-hmm. And I love that they've really inserted their spirituality and their culture, mm-hmm. and their history into their movies, and they're not afraid to do it.
It is a kid's film, Pompoko. It's just full of all this stuff that doesn't feel like it's watering it down for kids.
It's
at
really
the same
not.
Time.
Yeah.
I think of that scene where the kids, after the raccoons kind of transform the landscape, they go out and they look in wonderment at the raccoons, and the raccoons kind of bow at the kids.
Yes.
I sort of picture like a lot of kids kind of coming away with that scene when they watch the film and
yeah.
thinking about that. Maybe if they ever see raccoons in the wild. Or...
Yeah, I think that's the hope, is that you know, you're respectful of nature.
Right. One thing we haven't talked about yet, but I think maybe might be worth bringing up, is the Rascal the Raccoon.
Oh yeah, okay. The Disney Which, movie.
Well, there's the live action Disney movie from 1969. It's from
Memoir.
Yeah.
Sterling North, I think.
Yeah, it's Sterling North. But I thought it was interesting, like, there was a really popular Japanese animated version.
And I did, like, a little bit of research online. I don't know if you have better luck than I did, but I couldn't find any of the episodes in English. I think I found a few, like, in German. And
yeah,
I don't know German.
I found the German ones, too.
Yeah. And I was like, this is wonderful. I'd love to watch this. And I loved the opening. And the music is almost identical, if not very similar, to the music in the 1969 Disney movie.
Yeah, it seemed like probably whoever made the animated version had probably seen the Disney film in addition to reading the book. I watched a couple episodes in Japanese, just kind of following along. Like, it, right off the bat, it kind of Bambis you with the raccoon's mother getting shot. And
oh, jeez. Okay.
Yeah, it's like in the first episode. But it was sort of famous, I guess, or it made raccoons kind of famous in Japan, and people wanted them as pets. And then, like, the end of the series, he lets Rascal the Raccoon go back into nature.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Disney version, he fights a cougar or something.
Yeah, the two raccoons take on a cougar. I don't know how likely that is, but yeah.
No, he messes that cougar up. But I guess for a lot of people watching the animated series, their big takeaway is, oh, maybe I should let my pet raccoon back into the wild.
Mm-hmm.
Which, instead of the wild, it's probably like the trash bin outside. So I guess Japan had a raccoon problem from that. One thing I learned reading about all this for this episode is that Japanese raccoons and North American raccoons are two completely different animals.
Yeah, like the ones in this that's in Pompoko are raccoon dogs. I mean, they look very
much like
a raccoon. And then I think the English American, like, translated version, when I watched that getting ready, they just refer to them like we have been as raccoons.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they are raccoon dogs. And I think they said they're related to foxes. They're not actually related to the same kingdom that the raccoons are.
They're not even
are.
Part of the same genus.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, it would be just two different subspecies or something.
They,
like,
look,
it's not
so
the same
similar
animal at all.
Yeah.
But I guess the Japanese ones, they don't have hands like North American raccoons.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Hmm.
Like in Pompoko, whenever they show the realistic raccoons, they're always kind of running on all fours, and you don't see them sitting and handling stuff the way
that's true
raccoons here do. So
yeah,
I thought that was worth bringing up on this episode.
No, yeah, they are different, unless you watch, you know, the English dubbed version where they're raccoons, mm-hmm. which is funny because there's also another weird change, and I just thought it was silly. And the scene where they in the Japanese one where they just say that they're eating McDonald's hamburgers, like, during their break at their meeting.
Yes.
And then you watch the American version and they don't use the word McDonald's, I think for obvious reasons. They're just like, oh, these hamburgers, they're delicious. And there's just weird little changes like that throughout the movie.
I don't know. Sometimes, like, the whole, like, legal loopholes and things can get a bit funny and strange. And sometimes going back and forth between what people are aware of in Japan versus what they're aware of in North America, like, it can be a bit weird. I don't know if you've ever looked into the whole Simba from The Lion King versus Kimba the White Lion debacle.
I did, like, years ago when I did something on The Lion King.
It's sort of weird that Disney could just basically more or less rip this thing off and then threaten to sue them for stealing their idea, like, so
it's absolutely insane. And on that Lion King topic, unrelated, I'm not going to be seeing the quote unquote live action version.
How can they call it live action? All. It's yeah. just computer. I don't think people know what live action means.
I don't think so either. And I just, it's just such an obvious cash grab. It's like, why would I want to watch an animated movie that I do enjoy, that is really good, redone frame by frame?
Hey, this looks just like you remember it, but with CGI now. Like,
yeah. I think the only one I've seen of theirs is Beauty and the Beast, which was that was horrible getting through. I didn't like it at all.
No, the only one I kind of liked of the live action remakes was the Cinderella one.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Can you imagine a live action Pompoko?
Oh,
it's weird enough as it is.
With that the would pouch just, like... scenes? Yeah.
It would just escalate.
I'm all set. Nobody would buy popcorn.
No, some things should stay as cartoons.
Yeah.
if there's one takeaway from this episode. I forgot what got me on that whole Disney tangent. Sorry. No, I remember. I was thinking, like, in contrast to Rascal, it has a very sort of different relationship between the humans and the raccoons. You know, the raccoons at the end, that's the most interaction you really get, is between the kids and the raccoons nodding at them, other than the raccoons sort of playing tricks and doing mystical things. But like the realistic raccoons, that's really all you get is sort of the same kind of encounter you might have running across one in the wild. And it almost feels like corrective from Rascal, where the raccoon's a pet, and you know, it kind of, you probably shouldn't release a pet back into the wild once it's domesticated. And
yeah, because they're not gonna know what to do, how to fend for themselves and how to hunt. And yeah,
no, and like clearly that turned into a problem with people letting their raccoons go. And
I read that article. That was interesting. It reminded me of I think was it when Finding Nemo came out, everybody wanted the clownfish as a as an aquarium pet, and they were just putting them in fresh water.
Oh no, it's terrible.
There was I remember when that first came out, and I read some article on that, and people were just,
it's the most finicky just killing kind of fish.
all of these Nemos. Yeah,
I mean, I was looking if Takahata even had something to do with the Rascal show, and he didn't, but like it kind of came out at the same time as a lot of the early Takahata stuff, like Heidi or Go Panda Go. Like it all had a little bit of that look to it, just in the design and the color and that era of Japanese animation. Like,
right,
you know, so it seems like something you probably would have been aware of. And you know, it doesn't directly, but it almost feels like Pompoko,
yeah,
in contrast, does things differently when dealing with people and raccoons.
Yeah, it does. I think it deals with it, and besides them fighting them in that manner, using
like raccoons
their...
can be dangerous to people, and you can be dangerous to them, and we're sort of better off separate,
especially towards the end. Yeah, when they're showing that the ones that can't transform, how they have to survive and deal with cars and dealing with living in an urbanized area, and you know, basically hopefully relying on trash and maybe friendly people that will feed them. That's much more realistic.
Yeah, and I mean, there is sort of this underlying theme of raccoons not really being able to resist their nature, and it's sort of cruel for them to be dressing up like people and living like people. Or even like, it's sort of funny when they say, oh, we don't have food for any more cubs, so like none of you have cubs. And then, you know, there's that romance in the middle of the film where it's like, oh, good thing we're not kissing. And then like, two scenes later, they have cubs. So, you know... It kind of reminded me of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yes. A little bit, yeah. Also, I like how with Pompoko, the parade, I don't want to go to there if you wanted to go on another tangent with me on something Disney-related or anything, but the parade, the yokai parade, I thought of Satoshi Kon's Paprika, which I know came out way after this, I think like 2006, but there's that wonderful nightmarish parade, and it's not...
With the, like, dolls, and it's like getting bigger and bigger.
All like these inanimate objects, if I remember correctly. Yeah, and that parade is wonderful. It's probably the most similar thing, I think, to this, or even with Miyazaki's Spirited Away, when the spirits first start arriving on that boat. And then they land, and they are crossing the bridge into the bathhouse. That's somewhat similar, I guess, in a way, to a weird little parade with the spirits or gods or ghosts. But it's really more that sequence in Paprika that it made me think of, who also, Stashi Khan, he passed away pretty young. I think he was 46, and he died
very young. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate, because his movies are another interesting thing to discuss.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but that's a really good comparison with Paprika. Like,
yeah,
it sort of makes me think that a sequence like that can be just a celebration of animation.
Yes.
You know, like, it doesn't really forward the story when you're watching it in Pompoko, but, you know, it's just amazing seeing these designs and creatures all moving and doing and interacting with people. Maybe it's an animator's nightmare to put together. I don't know, but
it,
like,
kind of literally is too a nightmare. Yeah. It's like, it's like this totally dreamlike
sequence.
Yeah.
Too.
And I feel like when I'm watching Takahata's movies or Miyazaki's, or it's just, mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, maybe this was a dream, and unlike me, they were able to wake up and write it down and turn it into something. A lot of them really have this, this dreamlike quality to them, just like those parades.
Yeah. Well, he did it with live action, but Kurosawa's dreams, it actually kind of mm-hmm. makes me think of, now that you mention it, like,
yeah.
The opening, when you have the foxes that the kid
yes.
oversees, like, you know, you have those foxes in Pompoko during that parade, all dressed up in kimonos and dresses, and, you know, that's very similar. And then, like, you know, you have the undead soldiers in Kurosawa's dreams. And then, yep. of course, at the very end, you have that procession of the death, the kind of celebration of the old man's end of his life.
Yes.
You know, that's sort of has a similar feel. Yeah, I think you're right that it has this sort of dreamy
I think so.
quality,
I mean,
to it.
That's
yeah.
just how I take their movies. And I mean, I know they all have their little individual themes. I mean, they're kind of, in a lot of ways, opposites, Takahata and Miyazaki, with how they, mm-hmm. I think they handle things and the style of animation. And even their styles are, like, just so different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that way, they complement each other. And they're also supposedly really different from each other, or they were really different from each other.
Personality-wise. They had those kind of opposing personalities that maybe drove one another forward. And, like, that, you know, again, the Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, you can kind of see on the periphery while Miyazaki's working on The Wind Rises, Takahata's working on Princess Kaguya, and them kind of, you know, in competition, and they have
yeah.
sort of different.
And Takahata's barely in that documentary.
He's barely in it, but, like, yeah. I guess they're both busy. And, like, mm-hmm. isn't there a part where like Miyazaki's just complaining about, like, how messy Takahata leaves the studio?
Yeah, he said something like, if I remember correctly, he, like, went away to his cabin in the woods or something, and he said he came back and my studio is a gigantic mess. Like, you know, the Takahata, thank you.
I should rewatch it. That's a really good documentary.
It really
is. I like that. A lot.
It's such, like, it's like, you're kind of, just gives you, like, an entire just viewpoint and access to Studio Ghibli that you wouldn't have, I feel like, unless you worked there the way it is.
It feels really unfiltered. Like, so many
yeah.
documentaries, especially that have to do with the production of films, can feel really
oh,
kind of calculated.
Totally
and
orchestrated.
Everyone's only going to say nice things about each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, like Miyazaki comes across, like, maybe almost manic, like, going between
mm-hmm.
these, like, depressive bouts to, like, high energy to, you know, extreme creativity to, like, changing his mind how they should end the film at the last minute. Like,
yeah, yeah. And even the note that they had, I feel like it may have been towards the entrance of their studio. And they kind of zoom in on it a few times. And in that documentary, it's like, if you don't feel like being creative or something, you should quit.
Yeah.
It's like,
no, and you just see how hard those animators work. Like,
oh gosh, yeah,
tough, prolonged work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He's working on a new one, I guess, right now. But
yeah, he's always retiring and then coming back, which is a good thing that he comes back. But yeah,
I sort of picture it like, you know, when you have a project that taxing and that hard, you can't even think of doing another one.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to, like, quit and walk away for a little while. But if you're creative, you eventually find your way coming back to it. And I think compared to a lot of the other ones, Miyazaki's taking a long time with the one he's working on right now. He has
yeah.
an extra long production schedule, and it seems like
it's like channeling Takahata, it seems.
And, well, hopefully, like, he's just sort of pacing himself and not trying to burn himself out working on it. And
yeah,
you know, if I had to broadly characterize the difference between them, I always feel like Miyazaki's films are, the animation is about flight and flying, and you think of, like, Kiki's Delivery Service or Castle in the Sky and all the
yeah.
flying, and, like,
yeah.
and Takahata's animation, I always think of, like, the transforming, like, things shape-shifting and turning into something else, and, you know, a bamboo turning into a person, and,
right.
you know, you see a lot of that,
You
in
do.
His films. That's so great... like it's just kind of interesting to see where.
That's a great point. They're both very different. Yeah.
So I don't know, interesting, and I'm glad you picked this film. Like it's sort of,
it's different. I don't feel people talk about it a lot.
I guess because like within the pantheon of Ghibli movies, it kind of falls into like a weird niche maybe for a lot of people. And I know it had a North American release, but I think it got released way after it was released in Japan. Like it got released late because I remember just as a kid, like I was maybe too young for when like Totoro got released, but I remember watching it on videotape. And then like I remember Kiki's Delivery Service when it was coming out. It was like a pretty big, you know, there were like ads for it. And I didn't know Pompoko existed till like probably the mid-2000s, you know.
Which is funny because I think that might have been when it was released on DVD here, was like 2005, 2006 maybe. So yeah, late. So after Spirited Away.
And I don't know if it was like an issue where, hey, Ghibli, what else do you have? And, you know, this was like sitting on their shelf, or if they just didn't think it was marketable because it's sort of weird for a North American audience maybe. So yeah. I don't know. They still gave it like the big fancy voice cast like they usually do. But like there's a couple other Ghibli films I think also kind of get that niche treatment. Like I think Only Yesterday is the one that was just released, right?
Yeah.
And that was made like 1991. And like, I don't know
excellent.
If that's... yeah. Like, you know, again, another Takahata film that just... It's so good, but like maybe it's not as accessible for a North American audience as like the high fantasy of a lot of Miyazaki stuff.
Do you think it's the pacing? Because that's what I think. Like I think because it's the pacing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely part of it. And also, I mean, these films are pretty long for a young audience. Like I think
they are.
Only Yesterday might be over 2 hours, right?
It might close be. To it. Like, it's definitely, I think it's at least, you know, I have a copy here. Hold on.
Okay. Pompoko was like right almost at 2 hours. I'd guess like it's probably something similar. Only Yesterday.
It's exactly 2 hours long. Only Yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah. But so yeah, it is a little long. I mean, cause I feel like most animated movies here are around 1 hour, 30 minutes.
Yeah. So it's, and like that's an incredible film, but like it sort of deals with maybe more adult themes at some points, or like, you know, a mature person kind of looking back on their childhood. And
yeah, they cover puberty and menstruation in Only Yesterday. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that, I mean, at least as far as you can't, I haven't seen everything, nobody can see everything. I don't remember seeing an animated film here that covers that. So I guess kind of in the way that Pompoko deals with their magical scrotums. So it's something they can't really do.
Only
here.
Yesterday it's very like matter of fact, and then
yeah, except for the scene where like boys are trying to like peer underneath the girl's skirts.
Yeah, that it's gross. But
but even like you said with Takahata and Miyazaki being so different from each other, this movie made me really think of the differences they had between each other, Pompoko, because of just the way that the way that it ends. I mean, it is as sad as it is and as dark as it is. It's this idea that we have to find a way to live together with the humans, and it's kind of how Takahata and Miyazaki, I think, from what I understand, were able to really work with each other. Like, I feel like they were able to come to that middle ground, as different as they are. It's like, I remember, I think it might have been an interview I listened to. I don't know if I read it or it was an interview somebody had, but it might have actually, I think it was Miyazaki giving the eulogy for Takahata when he passed away. And he mentioned something like that he called Takahata Mr. Munch because he would always arrive at work. It was like just the way he was. He was always arriving at work really late. And Mr. Munch, because as he was like punching in his time clock, he was still eating whatever he had for breakfast,
right?
Because he was just in such just disarray and a mess. And Miyazaki is the complete opposite. Like, I think he arrives at work like every day at 11 and then doesn't leave until 9 p.m. So he's just totally strict and I guess and conservative by the books in that way with his schedule. Mm-hmm. And then Takahata is just like basically a complete mess. So, but that they find that middle ground, just kind of like the way the raccoons and the humans do.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's beautifully put. So thank you for coming on to talk about Pompoko, Amanda. And
thanks for having me, Martin.
if folks want to follow you on the internet or check out anything you've done, where can they look?
You can look for me on at WMassLiberty on Twitter, and I'd be happy to talk. I'm into movies of all kinds, and I play a lot of video games as well. So I'd be happy to talk anything with you. More on Pompoko, too, if you wish. Absolutely.
Awesome. And if folks want to follow the show, it's at FlixWise on Twitter. I'm at MovieKessler on Twitter, and you can check out FlixWise.com and all that stuff, you know. And this podcast will transform into something peculiar. I think maybe next one...
A live-action Disney movie, yeah.
Until next time, listeners, take care.
You need some energy drink, maybe, because...
yeah, I should have a raccoon energy drink. Before you turn back into a raccoon. Yeah. I look like a raccoon lately.
That's okay.